Well, boy, we have a fantastic class. Plenty of people here. So why don't we get started? I want to welcome everybody to tonight's PPS Success Mentor Teleclass series. If this is your first seminar, let me introduce myself. My name is James Phelps, and in addition to being your host for tonight's call, I'm the PPS Success Educational Coordinator. Tonight we're just extremely fortunate to have with us J.P. Sears, who will be talking about finding success beyond the control drama of self-sabotage. If you've just joined PPS, or if this is your first PPS Mentor Teleclass, I want to say a few words about J.P. In addition to being a Czech Level 4 Holistic Lifestyle Coach and Czech Institute faculty member, JP is a specialist in holistic emotional healing and our resident PPS success mentor in that area. JP runs his practice in holistic emotional healing and lifestyle coaching out of the Czech Institute in Vista, California. And in addition to teaching Czech Institute courses as a member of their faculty, JP offers his own course entitled The Essentials of Holistic Emotional Healing. I'll say, personally, that I know JP to be a pretty wise and compassionate guy, and not just because he survived a year with me at the Czech Institute, but because I had the good fortune to benefit from his coaching in the past. So if you want to learn more about JP and the services he offers, I invite you to visit his mentoring page located at in the PPS mentoring section of our website at www.ppssuccess.com. And you can also visit JP's personal website at www.holistichealthandfitness.com. Now, before we begin tonight, I'll remind everybody that we do record these calls. So if you happen to be in a high traffic area or you're on a cell phone that might pick up some echo effects, I recommend that you mute your line until you have a question by pressing *6. And then if you want to join in the conversation, you can unmute your phone at any time by pressing any button on your phone pad. Otherwise, I'll leave the lines open tonight so that we can have more of an open discussion.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, James.
No. I was just going to say that's all I have to say. So now it's my turn to shut the heck up and turn everything over to you.
Well, James, I have one quick question for you. Based on everything you can see, can you argue with the thought that I'm the best-looking one on the call tonight?
Oh, boy. You know, JP, you're a pretty sharp-looking guy, but there's a lot of people with us.
Well, what I like best about the teleclasses is I can get a little bit more delusional about my levels without being called out. So I can see you're not going to let me do that, James. But thank you very much for the intro. I sure appreciate it, James. And thank you to everybody who's on the line for joining me tonight and just being an equal partner in this game called life. It's always a pleasure to me to either talk or just sit with a group of like-minded folks. And so here I am feeling pretty blessed to be in this moment. And before we dive into the agenda tonight and I become the alpha male and do some talking and act like I have control, I'd love to find out who's on the line, and if you'd like to introduce yourself just by first name or first and last name, or you can make up a name, you can do that. And if we have your permission to do that, if we could start with folks near the west coast of the U.S. and then work our way around the globe, I'd like to take a minute to do that. So love to hear who you are on the line.
Hi, JP. It's Nancy Jaraminski out in Seattle.
Hey, Nancy.
How are you?
Good.
Can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Me too. Who else is with us?
This is Tony Herndon from San Diego.
Hey, Tony.
Hey, JP. It's Sven and Tom from San Diego.
Hey, Sven and Tom. Thanks for joining us. Who else we have?
It's Beverly from Tucson.
Hey, Beverly. What? Anybody, as we work our way a little bit more east across the country, anybody join from that?
Margie Rush from Colorado. This is Tom Biancolana from Chicago.
Hey, JP, it's Annie in South Carolina.
Hey, Annie.
Gary Carl in Rochester, New York.
Miranda Remington from Arlington Heights, Illinois.
Thanks for joining us. Anybody else like to speak up?
Tom Lister in New York City.
We heard some New York City folks, and who else is with us?
Lee Zimmerman, San Diego, California.
Hey, Lee.
Hi.
Meg Sears, Bowling Green, Ohio.
Well, we've got my mom on the line, so Jesus Christ. who else is with us?
This is Cameron from Australia.
Hey, Cameron, how are you?
I'm well, and you?
So far, so good.
Very nice.
Hi,
JP. This
like
is Presley from New York City.
Hey, my friend.
JP, I don't know if you could hear me, but it's Margie Rush from Boulder, Colorado.
Yes. Thank you, Margie.
Okay.
Well, anybody else, whether you're on the upside or downside of the globe or not even on the globe?
Hey, JP, it's Brandon out
from Ottawa, Canada.
Hey, guys.
Tark and Chase from Vermont.
Well, thank you guys for introducing yourselves. If there's more of us on the line who didn't speak up, that's absolutely fine as well. And as we truck along with, honest to God, what for me is a short period of time to cover a very meaningful topic, I guess right away I'll just get out of the business of saying we're going to cover it. We're going to take a little bit of a corner and consider some aspects of it. With a lot of the topic of finding success beyond the control drama of self-sabotage, a lot will be left to explore. Yet one of my purposes today is to open some, open the doors to some of the mysteries for us to walk away and consider. And as we go along, if you have questions, you're more than welcome to speak up. And given that we've got a number of folks on the line, I'll just pretend like I have control of the call, even though I won't. So that's going to be one of my control dramas. I'll also pause at various intervals and ask for questions if you've got them. And for me, they're absolutely welcome to be asked. That's why there's more than one of us on this call, not just me dabbling to myself. So off we go. Just a brief outline of the outline I'd like to cover tonight, but just a brief rundown of what I'd like to get to is we'll briefly talk about, one, what is self-sabotage. Two, I'd also like to consider, does the appearance of being successful mean that we're still not self-sabotaging at some level? I'd also like to speak directly about control dramas and why I believe most people, most of the time, are acting out control dramas in their life, and how self-sabotage and blocking our own success is just one of those control dramas. I'd also like to talk from another angle about how many of us learn to get our emotional needs met through becoming a martyr, becoming a saboteur, where a lot of that actually happened earlier on in life when essentially the computer was being programmed. We were running around pooping our pants. Some of us don't do that today, yet we still have our computer programmed with the same software, so I'd like to bring some attention to that. I'd also like to speak about the idea of how many of us walk around today in an altered state, which basically means we're hypnotized, and how being stuck and frozen leaves us prone to self-sabotage. I'd also like to talk about how when we were punished as kids, whether it was other people punishing us or us punishing ourselves, or us punishing other people for that matter, how those programs that we've still got running today, even though we don't see them, how that affects our ability to succeed or our ability to sabotage. I'd also like to talk about the deeper meaning of our goals, where when we set a goal, we think we know what we're talking about, when then the reality is there's always a deeper meaning to the goals that we set, found in a higher level of consciousness that we can access. So with that said, you can see that I'm already loading the plate up with a whole bunch of stuff that we can't possibly cover in an hour. So I guess right away I can see that I've sabotaged this call. Whatever's wrong with me, I'm not totally sure. And then if I'm getting incredibly optimistic, then what I'd say is at the end of the call, I'd like to ask for a volunteer who feels like they've got an issue in their life that they're somehow stuck in, where they're not meeting the level of success that they otherwise believe that they could. So with that laid out, with your permission, we'll jump in. So if I could have the liberty of giving you my definition of self-sabotage, in this moment, what it means is there's different parts of me with conflicting agendas, where there's a part of me, usually at the conscious level, that believes I want to succeed in a certain way, whether it's losing weight, making money, having more intimacy, whatever it is. And where the self-sabotage comes in is there's a part of another part of me, this time usually at the subconscious or unconscious level, that has a completely opposing agenda. It looks at the agenda of success and says, no, that doesn't work for me. Somehow that represents something unsafe or something just out of my scope. And therefore, this unseen aspect of us learns to self-sabotage, learns to block our own success. Another definition of self-sabotage that I'll put out there, because I like to get schizophrenic and have multiple personalities talking, but for me, another definition of self-sabotage is where part of us creates an expectation only for another part of us to fail in meeting that expectation so that we can sit in the shame, the frustration, and the anger, even the self-loathing, that we weren't able to meet our expectations. So I'll ask you this question for you to contemplate. What would it mean if you could actually uncover these parts of us that operate at a very hidden level, the parts of us that have the agenda of setting expectations so we could fall short and so that we can feel like crap? And you'd say, why in the hell would we ever, even unconsciously, be motivated to make ourselves feel like crap? And that's a good question. A brief answer to this question that we'll expand on in a little bit is, it's simply one way we learned to get our emotional needs met. So I'm excited as we open that can of worms. And when we look at success, a lot of all of us on the line have our version of what success means to us and our version of what area of our lives we're looking to gain success in. You know, whether it's losing weight, gaining weight, improving our fitness, having more money, having more intimacy in our lives, having more joy, expressing more creativity, getting along with other people, standing up for ourselves. Those are some examples, but I'll just ask you to take an inner inventory right now and consider what area of your life success is important for you at this time, at least. And with that said, I'd like to consider the question, how is it possible that the appearance of success can actually be a compensation for real sabotage going on underneath. The reason why I want to ask this question is I have the opinion that most people, I'm actually going to get a little crazy and say all people have an element of self-sabotage. So we look at people who, taking the concept of money, people who are incredibly successful money-wise, and we'd say, gosh, it'd be kind of blasphemy to say that they self-sabotage. But I would just say, well, is it possible that they actually do self-sabotage and their incredible success with money has been actually a compensation to distract themselves from how they're really self-sabotaging themselves, how they're sabotaging the tenderness of their own heart or the intimacy in their relationships? And that's certainly not a knock for those of us who have money. It's not saying, well, you're screwed up. It's saying, well, you're at least as screwed up as everybody else. It's just we don't want the illusions that we buy into to blind us to the areas that we can actually have further growth. Another area of success that people can commonly create for themselves would be having a very fit body or a very healthy body. Yet we wouldn't want to forget what other aspects of our life may be being sabotaged. Got great success here, but where else might I be sabotaging? So that brings me to a question. I'd like to open this up for anybody in the group. In the title of this teleclass, I use the word control drama. So I'd like to ask for somebody's input, their opinion of why people use control dramas to get their emotional needs met. How could that look? No, not everybody all at once. When everybody speaks at the same time, the phone line just clogs and it comes out with silence. Who'd like to take a guess? You don't have to be right. I think there's many answers to this question.
It's the easiest way to do it, JP.
Ah, sounds like a wise man. It's the easiest way to do it. I like that answer. Who else has some contribution there? Well, we'll go with that. It's an easy way to do it. And what makes it easy to get our emotional needs met through control dramas is the fact that it's very familiar. And why that becomes familiar to us is, and why we adopt control dramas in the first place, is we're considering how the control dramas can actually become an incredible block to our success. I would like to ask you to consider this thought. Could it be true that the human ego is fearful of anything that it can't control? I don't know what your answer is on that, but right now my answer for me is, yeah, I think that's true. The human ego actually becomes very fearful of anything it can't control. So as we're birthed into this world going through an incredibly uncontrollable experience from the ego's point of view, we quickly learn how to gain a sense of control just to feel a sense of safety in this world. And the sense of control often starts as us controlling our parents. You know, as we're very little children, if you want to see a control freak, actually go look at a 4-year-old or a 2-year-old or even a 1-year-old. They know that when they cry, they're going to be controlling the situation. They know that when they act very cute, they're going to seduce others into sharing their attention with the child. And that doesn't make it a bad thing. It just means it's one way that we learn to feel safe, to get our emotional sense of safety met. Also, if you want to see another control freak, of course you and I could go look in the mirror. The only difference between most people today and a four-year-old is a four-year-old is typically less seductive about being a control freak. They're typically pretty pure with it, whereas today I know in my life there's many times when I act out four-year-old childish controlling behavior, yet I have to seduce myself and seduce others around me into making it appear something different. So what else I would say about this whole deal of why we want a sense of control? Yeah, right from the get-go, early on in life, why we're looking for it. The sense of control not only gives us a sense of I'm safe, but it also creates the illusion of power. So what I'm really saying is I narrate a little bit of this control drama stuff. What I'm really saying is there's unconscious child ego parts of you and I that know that if they can block you from losing weight or if they can block you from having successful relationships, then what they get to say is, I did that. I had control, therefore I feel powerful. Now, if this is even halfway true, then you could probably entertain the idea that this at all doesn't happen at our conscious level. We certainly don't think this out. It's very reactive behavior rather than responsive behavior. Another question for the group, if I could throw it out there. If it's true that we're all control freaks, and we're all control freaks because it makes us feel safe, and one of the ways we'll act out control drama is blocking our own success. If all that's true, my question for you guys is, why don't we just use peace and harmony as our control drama and control that as opposed to controlling self-sabotage? Does anybody have any input on that question?
This is Tony, and I think that it stems from self-sabotaging. You get the feeling that you get to blame others, whereas if you came from peaceful routes, you'd probably have to look a lot harder at yourself, and that's a lot harder for a lot of people.
Hmm. Well, the only thing bad about that, Tony, is it makes a lot of sense to me. And I heard you say, well, it allows us to get into the business of blaming others. So are you saying that some of us get our needs met by being a victim?
I'm sorry, I'm in a loud area. By being what?
By being a victim, by getting to blame other people.
Sure, it's easier to point the finger.
Yep. Thank you, Tony, for that contribution. Does anybody else have thoughts on why we don't use peace and harmony very often as a control drama?
The ego doesn't feed off of peace and harmony as easily as it does the self-sabotaging and blaming others, JP.
Thank you for that insight. And whose voice do I get to blame that insight on?
How's it going, JP? This is Brandon Alamo in Lafayette, Louisiana.
Hey, Brandon. Thank you for that insight. And if I could piggyback on that insight, Brandon, and Tony, I'm going to piggyback on your insight in just a minute. So the message I'm getting from Brandon, in my own words, is that peace, harmony, and even unconditional love come from a source beyond that of the ego. Therefore, the ego, which we all have, it's our sense of who we think we are, it's our sense of separation. But because peace and harmony come from beyond the ego looks at that and says, I simply can't control it. Therefore, what we control is actually not having that. when we act out childish control traumas. Now, of course, the more of an adult we become in life, and we go from being a child dressed up as an adult suit, we become an adult child dressed up in adult suit. So the more adult we become, the more conscious of these hidden aspects of ourselves we can get, the less they control us, the less they just get expressed through knee-jerk reactions and unconsciousness. Thank you guys for considering that question. And the final question I'll ask you guys with control dramas is this. Are you able to humble yourself enough to realize that you're as emotionally needy as a small child? And if you can do that, can you humble yourself enough to say, yeah, part of how I get my needs met is by being a control freak. And yeah, it's possible. Some of the time I may actually be a control freak by blocking my own success. While it feeds a part of me, it certainly feels like it's killing another part of me. So that's the question I'll pass on to you guys for just consideration. The next question I'd like to pose to the group would be, aside from just blatant general control dramas, what are some other ways that we would actually be getting our emotional needs met that would easily set us up for self-sabotage? Does anybody have any ideas to throw out? Well, I guess that means that I get to throw my idea out as I continue to be the alpha male of the group. That kind of makes me feel real powerful. But here, in this business about how else we get our emotional needs met that can set us up to block our own success, Tony, you mentioned the word, you mentioned blaming others, which for me brought up the word victim. The victim archetype we could probably talk about for a very long time, but in brevity, we'll just shine the light on it a bit. There's two polarities to this energy. There's the victim, and then there's the rescuer. And as a child, if you got your needs met primarily as a victim, meaning you became essentially somehow pathetic so that other people would take care of you, and through them taking care of you, their attention, of course, gave you a sense of, I matter because I got this person's attention. So we go on reactively figuring out ways to compromise ourselves only so we can get other people's attention so that we can get our emotional needs met. And so if that was your mode of operation when you were a kid, then how that can play out today is figuring out new ways to become pathetic. And pathetic sounds like a pretty judgy word, and it is. I'm just trying to put a little polarity on it so you can feel the energy of the word. A victim today, as it comes to money, for instance, a victim says, no matter how much money I don't have, it's still not enough. No matter how much debt I have, it's still not enough. No matter how much I hate my body, I still don't hate it enough. Because the same way we got other people's attention when we were a kid by becoming a victim, that's how actually part of our ego learns to get the attention from other parts of our ego today. So it may not involve external family members or friends today, though it probably does at some level. What it certainly involves is our internal pieces and parts and how they relate to each other. So I would just say whether your definition of success has to do with sports, how your body looks, your joy, your creativity, whatever it is. If you've got a human ego, you've got an aspect of it that is functioning of the victim archetype. And I bring this up simply so that you can consider it. If you know it's there, you know what to look for. The other side of a victim, by the way, is a rescuer. And typically a rescuer will take on the appearance of being very arrogant, believing that their mission is to help other people. So that might have been, well, gosh, when I was a kid, I would always go around and help other kids with their homework. Or, you know, I'd make sure I kept my room spotless so that I could make mom and dad's life easier. Or if somebody looked hurt, I'd go over and make them feel better. And what happens with a victim is no matter how much we try and make other people feel better, truly with the sole purpose of trying to make ourselves feel better because we made them feel better, what a rescuer is always left with is the shame that no matter how much they try, it's never enough. Therefore, I believe that many of us today create situations in our life where we're ultimately left with a sense of failure. We embark upon the mission out of our rescuer archetype, but we're ultimately left feeling a sense of shame, feeling a sense of failure, or by the way, we'll just cover all that up with anger or indifference. Yet, the rescuer, if that's how your software is programmed, then what that means is you're going to try your ass off, but eventually you're going to have to fail. That can show up as, oh my gosh, well, I set up these new businesses and I've got my heart in the right place. But no matter how much I work my ass off over the last 5 years, 10 years, the businesses can't keep my head of, I can't keep their head above water. What that means is we spend our adult life replicating familiar patterns that were ingrained in our childhood. Now, that certainly can be a death sentence, or that can be the seed of new life, just depending on if we bring consciousness to it. We can certainly bring a death or a closure to our childhood values and our childish ways of getting our needs met, or said another way, of being completely and utterly codependent. And if we can do that, which I believe starts just by becoming aware of what we're doing, then through that death, we can give ourselves a rebirth and a new life of functional adulthood, functional interdependence rather than codependence. And with that, I believe a clearer pathway to success that doesn't have to be marred with self-sabotage as long or as much or as often. Could it still be there? I believe it certainly could. Yet the frequency and the amplitude of it gets to go down. So this business of the victim and rescuer is ways of getting our emotional needs. Two other polarities that I'd like to briefly speak to on other archetypes of getting our emotional needs met before I seal my lips for a minute and ask for questions and statements if they're out there. But what I'd like to just briefly mention is the polarity of being compliant or being defiant. Now, again, if we're compliant or defiant, we learn that pretty quick as a kid. And a compliant kid says, yeah, I get my needs met by doing exactly what mom and dad say. A defiant kid says, yeah, I get my needs met by doing the exact opposite of what mom and dad say. And what it actually is, it's a strong loyalty to our perceptions of our parents' values. And so you'll say, well, what's all that mean? Well, what I'd like to say is that can start to work against us, our reactive need to be either compliant or a reactive need to be defiant. Either way, it can put up an incredible hurdle to our success. As an example, if you happen to be an athlete and you say, well, gosh, what I want most, what would represent success to me would be to win. to be the winning athlete on the field. So our mission is to look at that and say, okay, that's a beautiful story. What's the story under that story? So we'd actually ask, and I'd like to go through details of this in a little bit, but for now I'll just say we'd ask winning. What does winning actually mean to you? I believe it's not the winning we want. It's the emotional attachment of what winning means to us that we actually want. So the answer might be, well, gosh, to me, winning would mean that I feel special, that I feel worthy, and that I'm accomplished. And I'd say, okay. Now, considering the compliance defines, what I'd ask is, well, gosh, think about your mother. What winning means to you, deserving, special, accomplished, does your mother believe she deserves that? And you'd have a look and you'd say, no, I don't think my mom feels inside. I don't think she feels special, worthy, and accomplished. So what that means is part of you is being very compliant with the unspoken but very present energy that you bathed in your childhood with your mother, her value that she somehow isn't deserving, isn't worthy, isn't special. So we become very unconsciously loyal to that. Now, of course, if we're defiant, we'd look at that and say, yeah, mom thought of herself as being very pathetic. So guess what? I became just the opposite of that. I went out and became very accomplished. Another way to be defiant is you'd say, yeah, I think actually mom was, she had a pretty whole heart and thought highly of herself. So why in the hell can't I win? I'd just ask you this question. Could it be that you learned to get your emotional needs met by being defiant to what your mom wanted? And same could be asked of your father. Now, at this point, I'd like to pause and just say that I've sped through some concepts that, to do justice to them, they need a lot more time. But with what was said, I'm curious at this point, what questions or statements, if any, do you guys have to offer?
JP, it's Miranda in Chicago.
Hi,
JP. I can't help but wonder, because this obviously runs around my head a lot, is let's just pretend that you get yourself checked to the point where you don't engage in the dramas. And let's just pretend, yeah, occasionally you do, but by and large, in comparison to your sphere of friends and family and coworkers and whatnot, you are so off the chart, not engaged in the control dramas and not engaged in the victim or the rescuer. You really just don't engage in that. What does that imply for what happens to, you know, basically your tribe? I mean, that's one thing to, obviously your ego's going to run around your head in fear, is that your tribe will collapse around you.
Well, leave it to a brilliant woman to bring up a brilliant question.
Oh, you flatter.
Yeah, that's my judgment, and hell, I don't know what I'm trying to seduce out of you, Miranda, but that is my opinion. Well, that's a great question, Miranda. If I got that straight, I heard you say, what happens when we don't engage in the common control dramas around us, and what actually happens to our tribe or our social network or the people that we used to belong to if we're not subscribing to the same control dramas they are? Could that be incredibly challenging and painful and even traumatic to the ego? Is that the question, Miranda?
You got it.
Well, very cool. If I could speak to that briefly, the first part of the question I hear is, well, there's two possibilities. We could actually be disengaged from common control dramas, or we can just have the belief that we're disengaged from common control dramas. Mm-hmm. One of the common control dramas that I like to subscribe to best, because I like to trick myself, is I actually seduce myself into believing that I'm not a control freak, and therefore one of my control dramas becomes leaving myself completely out of control, meaning somebody says, where would you like to go for dinner? And I'd say, it doesn't matter, anywhere. Where I take on the passive energy of a control freak rather than the active energy of a control freak. So that's just a little side note, just to say, well, if we think we're not a control freak, we just need to make sure we analyze ourselves. The next thing to say is, absolutely, we don't want to discount, Miranda, what you're saying, that when we embark with a heavy investment of self-growth, we absolutely do grow ourselves up. And the control dramas that used to serve us aren't serving us anymore. Therefore, as we choose not to engage in them as long or as much or as often as we used to, we don't have as much common ground with the folks around us. And therefore, this root chakra theme of needing a tribe to belong to, that can become incredibly stressful, because our friends say, you know, my boss is an absolute jerk. And as we don't invest in the drama, they look at us like we're from another planet, and they, well, I don't want to talk to you anymore. You're not going to energize my control dramas. So the real point, Miranda, that I'd like to just leave you with, and my hunch is it's one that you're absolutely aware of, is growing ourselves up has consequences. It's very often that the more we grow ourselves up, the more we change our friends, because the values that held our friendship together, well, they're shifting for me. Family members can grow apart. So could it mean that success comes with an incredible price tag? And by the way, would that also mean that self-sabotage comes with an incredible price tag? It's just there's positive and negative consequences to both.
Right, and you can inherently sabotage your growth because of that, wanting to, you know, continue to, quote-unquote, play small.
Yeah.
Just to get your emotional needs met.
Yeah. Well, thank you for blessing us with all that insight, Miranda. And any other question that needs to be asked in this moment?
JP, this is Tom.
Yes, Tom.
And I just have an observation that, you know, while you were talking about the compliance and the defiant side, you know, you mentioned that you can be, you know, gain control from either one. And I guess I just made this observation that, gosh, you know, I've been both. And I, you know, maybe I am both, or I'm maybe now more defiant to compensate for being compliant as a child. What that means, I don't know. But anyway, I just sort of observed that.
Thank you, Tom. My hunch is that you're not the only one that actually has both going on, whether it's at different times or different parts of the ego operating from a different archetype simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
Well, with that, I'm going to take the liberty of moving on, which I'll admit doesn't do justice to potential questions that I'm basically potentially stepping on by moving on. Yet, because I'm at times a slave to the illusion of time, off we go. The next thing, I'd like to just briefly touch on a couple other topics so that we can have some time left over here at the end. So the next thing I'd like to briefly talk about is how being in an altered state can keep us actually resonating at a frequency that seems to bring a whole lot of strife into our life. And one of the ways that happens, we'll understand that what's necessary to put us in an altered state is essentially fear. If you've ever hypnotized somebody, you know that one of the easier ways to do an induction is to create a fear response. And then they're very hypnotically suggestible, meaning they're in an altered state. So what causes you and I to go into trances doesn't have to be visiting a hypnotherapist. Typically, a hypnotherapist actually takes you out of the trances that you're already in. But it's typically it's times in our lives where we felt very overwhelmed or traumatized, and we'll go into an altered state. So the fear of the overwhelm will put us in an altered state. A common example that I come across in my work with clients is folks who will talk about their childhood and talk about all the responsibilities and obligations that they had. And I listen to what they're saying. I said, well, that'd be a lot for even a 30-year-old to handle. And they'll say, yeah, but I was six. So the overwhelm actually causes a fear response. And because it's too much for a small child to deal with, it's just the emotional circuitry. We haven't learned how to put lubrication in there to deal with the intense fears, shames, anger, etc. So actually to escape from the gravity of the discomfort, we would actually just go into an altered state. So we'd be there physically, yet part of the ego wouldn't be there emotionally, psychologically, or both, while actually other parts of the ego could still be very present. So our deal actually is to acknowledge that when we go into an altered state, in this case, let's just call it the fear of the overwhelm, that's the frequency that we actually resonate at when we're stuck in an altered state. And many of us have been having parts of us stuck in an altered state for many, many years. And it's kind of like if your radio is stuck on a station, that's kind of like, okay, there it is. It's stuck. The dial won't move. It's in an altered state. Yet the music that's playing from the station that the dial's stuck at, you listen to the music and say, well, that just produces a bunch of garbage. I hate that music. But we look at that and say, how can I turn the dial? Well, our deal is to realize that if we're stuck in an altered state because we needed to disassociate from fear or shame, we continue to actually replicate the emotional patterns that we were actually looking to escape. And typically the emotional patterns have a little bit less intensity and they don't peak quite as high, therefore they're easier to deal with, yet they build up. And year after year of always feeling like, well, people always pass me over or nobody notices me. It always seems like people undervalue me. What that actually means to some of us is part of me is in an altered state, disassociating from the real issue that I feel traumatized about. And therefore, what we resist persists. As long as we resist addressing the actual issue, the present-day circumstances of that issue will continue to persist. It has a lot to do with the law of attraction. Well, the next question that I would be tempted to ask at this point is, okay, JP, if what you're saying is halfway true, what in the hell do we do about it? What do we do to get out of an altered state? Well, thanks for asking. Thanks for letting me ask myself. My answer in this moment would say there's two aspects to getting ourselves out of an altered state. First would be to recognize that we're in an altered state. And you say, well, how do I even go about recognizing that? Well, that's a good question, because typically we're essentially in an altered state about our altered state. Therefore, we're blocked about seeing where we're blocked. So you say, how could we see that? Well, we can actually look and find different ages where challenging issues happen. And the challenging issues can serve as a little bit of a breadcrumb trail of finding where there was actually enough emotional discomfort that we had to disassociate from it. So you'll say, well, JP, are you saying that sticking my head in the mud of my own past actually has some merit? And I would say, absolutely. Provided that you're embarking with the mindset of, I'm sticking my head in my own mud, not to dwell on my issues, not to victimize myself, or not to blame other people, or not to blame myself for that matter, but to simply have the intention of processing the issue. By the way, I would say that it's probably worth me saying at this point, finding where we're actually stuck in an altered state, it can be an incredible value to have an external coach help you with that, because they're not necessarily blocked about your blockages, especially a coach who's willing to use the power of intuition. I know I'm regularly on the phone with my coach, John McMullen, and fortunate enough to work with Paul Check, who's also a very powerful, intuitive human being. So these guys help me find where I'm blocked. And a lot of the work I do with clients is using muscle testing and intuition to find where they're blocked about being blocked. Because the old saying, you can't get out of jail until you know that you're in jail. So that's the first aspect. The second aspect actually of getting ourselves out of an altered state has to do with feeling the feelings that were too threatening to experience at the moment of trauma, whatever the trauma was. And when I use the trauma, I'm not reserving the word solely for child abuse, car accidents, things like that. We all live through traumatic experiences. If you didn't, what that means is you're in an altered state to your traumatic experiences. And you'll say, well, JP, that's kind of arrogant to say, well, we've all lived through traumatic experiences. I would just say that if you didn't live through traumatic experiences, you're incredibly cursed. I believe that what's necessary in order to magnetize compassionate acceptance of ourselves, as well as a sense of love and a sense of self-acceptance, would be going through trauma. How can you ever know joy until you've gone through pain? The height that we can ascend in the relationships we have with ourselves, the height that we can ascend is purely dependent on the depths that we were willing to descend. That's why if you believe in the life of Jesus Christ, I believe the biblical story goes that he had to descend into hell before he could go into heaven. And if you look at that metaphorically, it may tell you a story, a little bit of a story about yourself. So the next thing I'd like to say is we're condensing about 6 hours of stuff into the next 5 minutes, but how I like to be optimistic. Is this. And for me, if there was nothing else I'm taking away from this call, this is what I hope I'm paying attention to the most, with my own words, is anytime you have a goal or a pathway for success that you're wanting to go down, what you're aware of is your literal story about your objective. Which is, of course, very important to have. So you might say, well, my goal is to lose weight. That would be the literal story. And what I'd like to ask you to do is consider expanding your consciousness into to what would be called, excuse me, it'd be called the metaphoric realm of consciousness. So you take your literal objective and ask yourself this simple question. What does that mean to me? What would it mean to me if I lost weight? Well, I might say, well, gosh, I'd have a sense of self-worth again. I'd feel like I was somehow free. So with this example, what we're really after isn't losing weight. What we're really after is an increased sense of self-worth, an increased sense of freedom. So that's very important to acknowledge, that what we think we're after is rarely what we're really after. There's actually a deeper level of consciousness that we can get to. Again, asking ourselves the simple question, what would it mean to me if I achieved that? Or what would it represent to me if I achieved that? So that's the metaphoric level of consciousness that I think is pretty important to get to. And also, you'll listen to your own words and also listen to the words that you don't speak. So in telling another person what you want to achieve, what you're also doing is, through the unspoken word, telling them what you believe you already don't have. So if I say, well, losing weight to me means I have a sense of self-worth and I feel beautiful again, what that's actually telling us is, somewhere in my past, I've lost my sense of self-worth. And I'm actually projecting my devalued sense of self-worth onto my present-day excess body weight. Therefore, I want to escape the gravity of that, and I'm creating a story about needing to lose weight. But the real deal is, somewhere along the line, I was actually compromised. And in order to truly make movement towards our success, I firmly believe that actually addressing the real issue, where it was when I lost my sense of self-worth, that's necessary for the external symptoms today of excess weight, only so that I can project my devalued sense of self-worth, which is, of course, a symptom of the wounding I had from my past. I believe it's very important to actually get to the real issue that caused the compromise. And hopefully that's not too crazy for any of us to think about. And by the way, this little piece alone, that it can just be a huge topic in and of itself. And in fact, it's a topic I do like to spend huge amounts of time in. Yet, as we're trying to make miracles happen in under an hour, I'll just leave that with you about taking your literal goal and expanding it into a metaphoric goal. What would it mean to me? And what would it represent to me? So at this point, I'll acknowledge you allowed me to cover a lot of words. And I'd like to take just a short window of time and ask if there's anybody on the line who would like to work on an issue they have about self-sabotage or success or where you feel stuck. So with that said, I'll close my mouth, and if you'd like to speak up, go for it.
I would. This is Lee from San Diego.
You said this is Lee?
From San Diego, yes.
Well, hello, Lee from San Diego.
Hello, JP.
Well, Lee, could you tell us in a nutshell, and by the way, thank you for the courage to work on an aspect of yourself in a room full of total strangers. With that said, Lee, what is it that you feel like you're blocked on or wanting to achieve?
Okay. Where I've been stuck lately is this letting go of the tribe issue.
Mm.
making some substantial changes for myself, which I've been working on for a long time, which I'm not complete, you know, haven't got all the way out through the other side yet, but far enough along, and am faced with how to deal with certain family members, really the only ones left in part of my family, my closest family, whom I believe are not healthy for me anymore, yet I also believe spiritually that my job is to just simply accept and love them for where they are and not have it affect me. Mm. However, it does. I know partly that's because I'm not finished with where I'm going, but I somehow am missing something about acceptance of them and how I then can fit in there when there's still a lot of negativity coming toward me because of their misunderstandings and their unwillingness to really ever see me, but are stuck in the past childhood stuff. I don't know what to do with that without I don't want to reject them and sever ties, yet I know it's not right for me to be with, not now anyway.
Thank you for presenting that. Lee, to make sure I've got it right, because it's a very important agenda you've got, in a nutshell, am I hearing you say my issue is how to unstick myself to my family members so that I don't have to have my being stuck to them at the expense of my own self-growth and self-expansion?
Yes and no. The self-growth and expansion I'm going to continue with regardless of however they may or may not be. But I think I'm stuck on the spiritual issue of wanting to accept them completely and love them unconditionally, yet I don't quite know how to make all that work. Maybe I'm just not far enough along yet. I know I'm going to see it, but I don't see it yet.
Thank you for clarifying. So you feel stuck in not being able to accept your family members for who they are and where they are. Is that true?
I can see that I'm more confused than I thought. yes and no. I think I've made this more complicated than it is.
You're doing fine.
The issue is to sever ties, or somehow just be in such acceptance of them and who they are and with whatever they do towards me that it has no effect on me, but also maybe that's all it is.
That works. And Lee, if you were to actually have all of this that you're looking for, what would that feel like to you? What would you guess it'd feel like on the inside?
When you say all this I'm looking for, I'm sorry, I'm not sure what you mean by that.
Yeah, how you're actually, if you were to get unstuck on this issue, what would it feel like to be unstuck on it?
Peace.
Interesting. Oh, thanks, Lee.
I think I got my answer.
Well, yeah, I bet you did. And Lee, what I'm actually hearing you say is, within myself, I lost a sense of peace somewhere along the way. And I've been projecting that loss onto family members and people around, and I'm looking to recover my inner sense of peace through them. Yet the real question that my hunch is connecting inside of you right now is it truly a sense of peace I'm looking for from them, or is the only person who can fill my peace up the person who wears my underwear?
Yeah, of course.
For you.
Right.
Leah, may we go a step or two further?
Sure.
Okay. Well, my hunch is that there's already energy moving inside of you about this issue by just allowing yourself to say your own words. And the word peace, that landed with some authority in me, too. I believe you're an intuitive human being, Lee, so I'm going to ask you to just take a guess. At what age would you guess you were when you lost this sense of peace?
3 or 4.
I believe that. And when you were 3 or 4, who did it seem like took your peace away? Who would you guess?
I get mother, father, brother.
Mother, father, brother. That works. And what was it about your 3, 4-year-old experiences with your mother and father and brother that felt unpeaceful?
I felt I couldn't get seen or heard.
Hmm. Gotcha. Well, thank you, Lee. And I'd like to just take a quick pause before we move on and ask you, Lee, in this moment, how does it feel inside your body?
Not getting seen or heard?
Where you're at right now, hearing your own words. What kind of body sensations do you have?
Tightness in my upper chest, tightness in my throat, pressure, like can't get enough air.
Yeah, that works. So is there a beautiful 3-year-old Lee who says, it feels very suffocating and obviously unpeaceful experiencing mom, dad, and brother in this way?
Sure.
Lee, I don't know if this is true, so I'll just ask it and let you be the judge. When you were at this age, were mom, dad, and brother somehow all connected via a common ground, and there you were typically on the outside? Or were you very inclusive in the circle?
Just to back up very briefly, I was adopted when I was 6 weeks old. So there's a little more complication, but I don't feel that I ever fit. And there's some biology and some environment involved with all that. Even some other things, which are kind of all wrapped up around it, but I think somehow at 3 or 4, this got locked in harder. Maybe I made a decision about it. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Lee. That, to me, feels very valid. I was adopted both environmentally and biologically. I never felt like I belonged. And, of course, what did it feel like to not belong?
Very scary. You were talking about fear.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
And to borrow your words, would it work to say pretty unpeaceful?
I always had, now this is even hard for me to say. This is like hard to even hold back now.
I bet.
But I'm going to because I need to be able to talk. So, the inner turmoil was huge because I could never really experience the unconditional love that I sought, which, you have to get when you're, well, you don't have to. Lots of people didn't, but that's important to get that as a child. Because, you know, without that, I see how I set up my life and how I created so many experiences, you know, to show me this. Forever.
Thank you. Thank you for your incredible vulnerability. And I would, at this point, just say that how you said those words for me was far more meaningful than the actual words you said. You're very soft in this moment. So I certainly don't have a hard time imagining how a three-year-old Lee had to spend some of her time, if not most of her time, in an altered state to disassociate from this intense fear that you're talking about. And Lee, I'm of the belief that the adult of today, who is you, has a gift for three-year-old Lee that she didn't know how to give herself in that moment. And I'm curious, would we be able to speak about that?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm already there. I mean, I haven't embraced this fully yet, but this is where I've been recently pretty intensely, which is, you know, underneath all of it is to give myself the unconditional love that I sought then. And that has driven me back to the mistake that I made literally when I was in a hospital waiting to bond with a mother that didn't come for 7 weeks. And I really lost my connection with God at that point. And then I went into fear at that point, even I think anger at that point. And I lost my connection to God so that I didn't have a connection with my family members or with God became unbearable, I think, for myself. Okay, here come the big tears again. But now what I'm doing slowly but surely, oh, it's not really slowly, but, you know, as I can make it more and more deep within me and feel that connection stronger and stronger, it's to reclaim myself as a child of God, you know, someone who has God within them. You know, connect with my true nature, which is unconditional love, which, you know, I'm having to let go of, you know, so many of these thoughts about myself and thoughts about others, all kinds of different states I've been in, from victim to, you know, a number of others, in minor or major ways in my lifetime. And now, you know, just sell all of those and embrace who I truly am. And, you know, I'm doing it kind of late in life. I mean, to this level. And my goal is, you know, I need to use my life to help others. And I can't do it the way I want to until I've done this.
I believe that. So can we help three-year-old Lee?
Sure.
I'm going to ask you to imagine she's sitting right in front of you, and you just imagine however she would look, just however she appears in your mind. And Lee, I'm going to ask you to say these words out loud. You can just repeat after me to three-year-old Lee. Try saying this. Say, it was living hell.
It was living hell.
What you had to go through.
It was living hell what you had to go through.
Yeah. No matter who was around.
No matter who was around.
You always felt alone.
You always felt alone.
And the message I carry for you today, three-year-old Lee.
And the message I carry, the message I carry for you, three-year-old Lee,
is to say that your suffering has purpose.
The message I care for you, 3-year-old Lee, is that your suffering has purpose.
By your always feeling on the outside.
By your always feeling on the outside.
You've given me the gift of motivation.
You've given me the gift of motivation.
To find wholeness on the inside.
To find wholeness on the inside.
You've suffered tremendously.
You've suffered tremendously.
My job is to notice that.
My job is to notice that.
And to help you deal with it.
And to help you deal with it.
By feeling what you never could feel on your own.
By feeling what you never could feel on your own.
These last words, Lee, we're going to translate all that into child language. And I'll ask you to extend your hand out to 3-year-old Lee and just say these simple words. Will you come home with me now?
Will you come home with me now?
What's happening inside your chest?
I pulled her inside of me.
How does she feel being inside of you?
She knows she can get the nurturing she needs here.
And how do you feel with her inside of you?
Not fragmented or split off.
You said not fragmented, not split off.
Right.
Lee, what are the sensations like in your chest that you reported earlier? Those still there? They changed?
Changed.
What's the feel right now?
More space. And I don't have the pressure that I had in my chest.
Lee, through your vulnerability, I will say this. My life is richer. Your willingness to soften your heart, speak from your heart, and invite a wounded little girl who feels all alone in life into your heart, I believe is just the meaning of it. I don't have words for. So all I'll say, Lee, is thank you very much. And Lee, I'm curious, do you have any more reflections to give voice to in this moment?
Just that I feel such a stronger sense of trust in myself, that so many of the feelings and thoughts that I had were the truth, and this is more confirmation about just trusting what I feel and following that, because that's also been a big issue for me. You know, what is the truth, and you know, do I trust what I feel or what others say, which is different than what I feel? I don't mean to be taking us back there again. Okay.
Well, Lee, thank you very much for the benefit of everybody on the line, for being the teacher in this moment, to model the process with wisdom rather than just hearing words about it through my mouth or others. You actually gave us the gift of wisdom. So thank you so much for that, Lee.
Oh, you're welcome.
Alex, please go ahead.
And I want to thank you. This is a huge gift for me, too. And I don't really have words to thank you for it. And, thank you.
I'll accept those words, and I'll accept your wordless token that I know is there.
And to anyone else who's still on the line, I want to thank them, too, because I somehow feel that there was a lot of goodwill coming my way that helped me to do what I did, love and goodwill. So thank you, everyone.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
I appreciate you acknowledging that, Lee. My hunch is there's no accident. Whoever's on the line had a purpose, mm-hmm. whether they know that or not. Their willingness to suspend time and space for this miracle to happen, it came from the collective consciousness.
Sure.
It's exponential, not linear. So from there, I'll just acknowledge that as the serendipity of life has it, we certainly eclipsed the hour mark that this teleclass was scheduled for. So if you've stuck with us, thank you for doing so. And I appreciate you letting me disregard that whole 60-minute deal we were supposed to contain ourselves within. So I would just like to give my parting words by saying I appreciate you joining us. I appreciate your sharing your words. I appreciate you sharing your unspoken words. And James, is there anything left on your end to announce?
Well, first, just to thank you very much for taking the time to spend with us tonight. It was a very enlightening evening, for sure.
Thank you, James. Well, to all on the line, I'll wish you a good night. If you're down under, I'll wish you a happy afternoon and look forward to talking to everyone soon.
Well, and I have a quick question for you, JP, because I know that you have a class coming up, The Essentials of Emotional Healing, Holistic Emotional Healing. And I was curious, is this sort of a sample of the sorts of things that you'll be doing in your class?
Thanks for the question, James. It is a bit of a sampling of what's in the class, strategies of reintegrating the parts of ourselves that have been lost, how to find them, this business of rescuing, victimization. What it all really comes down to in the class is it's a way of consciously reclaiming our power. So there certainly will be expansion of a lot of these concepts. I've got a one-day holistic emotional healing class coming up, I believe, November 2nd in Denmark. I've got a one-day version here in San Diego, December 12th. We'll also be planning various classes throughout 2010, also some new class topics, and we're just I was blessed last weekend to do a two-day version of the class in South Carolina with some very beautiful folks. And if you care about more details of that class, it is on my website, holistichealthandfitness.com. If you've got questions about it, feel free to give me a jingle or an email. Otherwise, anything else on your end, James?
I know that's it. Thanks again, JP.
Well, you're welcome, James. And good night to everybody out there.
Good night, everybody, and thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Good night, JP.
Good
I love
JP.
You.
JP, thanks.
Good night.
Thanks, JP. Thanks, James.
Good night. That's
great.
Thanks, James.
Good night, JP.
Good night.
Sounds like Little House on the Prairie.
Good night, John Boy.
Jinx.
Good night, Jim Bob.
Mary Ellen.
Yeah, I'm going, JP. Bye.
Goodbye, Nancy.